Robin Daly, and I'm your host for the show. This week's show is a little different. It's a personal story, something I do feature from time to time, but a very unusual one, I think, both in the diversity of subject matter it encompasses and in the questions it raises about the way that we practice many branches of medicine in the UK. The Esther Life Show is centred on integrative medicine for cancer. This story only includes a brief brush with cancer amongst a storm of other issues, but nonetheless, I feel it has much to say about integrative medicine generally as an approach to regaining health. I met Nanette McLeod Johnson in Edinburgh recently at Yes to Life's first Scottish seminar, and on hearing the broadest outline of her story, immediately resolved to feature it on the show. There's so much content, all of it important and compelling listening, that I've devoted two shows to it, and in the second one I shall be following the interview with a discussion with Robert Verkirk of the Alliance for Natural Health of the many issues it raises. Nanette and I met for the interview in North London. Good morning, Nanette.
Good morning.
Thanks a lot for coming to be interviewed. Yours is quite a story, and one of the most striking things having you sitting here is how unbelievably healthy you look. You look extremely healthy by anybody's standards. But what we're about to talk about is your journey you've been on, which has gone a long, long way from that. You've been incredibly ill in a lot of different ways. And it's a great testament that you found your way out of it. And so really, this is a bit of an investigation into what you found out along the way, how you managed to find answers for yourself. And so maybe you want to just start off by telling us, you know, when things started going wrong.
Okay, I would say that I noticed a change in how I felt when I was pregnant with my first child, Jessica. So that was she was born in February 98, so I would say around about 97. Hmm. And for leading up to that, I'd been a vegetarian, you know, fairly active for many years, you know, since my early youth. And I wasn't doing too well. My blood count wasn't doing too well. And I was recommended by my GP that I should take various, you know, anti-inflammatories and other bits and bobs because I have scoliosis and, you know, the concern about carrying a child. And
everybody knows, tell them what scoliosis is.
Scoliosis is it's a curvature of the spine. Okay. Actually, it's really a disease of the muscles. So the muscles contract whilst the spine is developing, and then the spine gets pulled and contorted into different angles. And I actually have scoliosis of the cervical spine, so it's quite high up in my neck. I also have slight kyphosis, so rather than the curvature going the right way, sort of out the way, it's almost too flat at the top. So it curves the side, it's also quite flat. And I have my rib cage is fairly twisted. My scapulars have completely winged, and you know, my right leg turns, and there's a lot of things. It's all a bit twisted up there. And but yeah, so that was the scoliosis, and it wasn't very comfortable when I was pregnant. And so, you know, having not really been too unwell in my life, I just listened to what my GP advised me, and not a problem. He also recommended I start eating meat because my iron and my blood count wasn't very good. Mm. I was sort of getting quite faint quite easily. So yeah, that was pretty much when it started. And then from then on, it just, you know, I just started to suffer with all sorts of inflammatory problems. My knees would swell up, terrible headaches. I just felt this fatigue that just washed over me, and there was nothing that I could do that would lift it. And I just didn't really know why at the time.
Mm. Despite the fact you're taking anti-inflammatories, you're actually getting more inflamed.
Yeah, and I didn't realise that at all. I thought, in fact, the more it happened, the more I should take, you know. And
right.
And so, yeah, that was the beginning of it, I would say.
Mm. Okay, so you describe yourself maybe as just sort of gradually in a worsening situation. It became a bit more of a crisis not so long after.
Yes.
Yeah, so maybe
fill that out a bit. So what happened was then, okay, so that was in 98. Then I over the years, I just sort of learned to live with it, I suppose. You know, when you have children, you do. You sort of just adapt with your lifestyle. And I got myself into, you know, routines and whatnot. But then I think when my... 5 years later, I had... when we had Sunny, our second child, it actually... it became worse, so because I had to go and see a physiotherapist because they were, again, they were concerned about me carrying a child, and they said, again, you know, with the anti-inflammatories, and again with the, you know, sort of this is what you need to eat, and this is what you need to stay away from, and all of these things that I was taking, unbeknownst to me at the time, were actually adding to my own condition and making life harder for me. So when Sunny was born, I actually had started, I had trained in Reiki, and I had done this because I wanted to be able to help myself. I wanted to be able to make my body as healthy as possible so I could be as good a parent as I could be to my children.
Right.
Because I was so tired these days, you know, sort of extreme fatigue was a fairly common thing for me, no matter how much I slept, and the pain, I just, you know, I couldn't, I just felt really unwell and quite headachy and migraines whenever I was taking medication. And but I didn't really realise it was a medication. I just thought it was my condition.
Well, you would assume, wouldn't you, that the medicine was there to do you good, and that you were suffering from a problem that you were trying to deal with. Yes,
precisely. So this is why I thought, okay, well, I had read about Reiki, and I had actually lived in Hong Kong for quite a number of years, and you know, so these were not new things to me, but I hadn't myself experienced them. So I decided to, I trained in this in Reiki, became a Reiki master, as they call it. And, and you know, I actually started a complementary therapy business at the time when my son was quite young, because it allowed me to work self-employed and still be, you know, full-time parent. Jessica was in school at the time, and Sonny, who actually has Asperger's, he was diagnosed with Asperger's. We noticed in him quite young that, you know, this was obviously something that he was struggling with. So it allowed me to work with him as well, and, you know, sort of be a hands-on mother whenever I need, whenever he needed me there. And but then after working for a couple of years in this field, I helped, ironically, I helped a lot of people, but I wasn't doing very well at helping myself. And I sort of, you know, I discussed this with Danny, and I thought, you know, perhaps this, I need to, you know, do something different. You know, I need to sort of do this, but also go on and, so I can, I decided that to train in psychology would be a way of helping other people, because I didn't think I was very good at Reiki, because I wasn't, you know, sort of doing too much to help myself. So, however, the therapy side of talking to other people definitely had, you know, from my, the feedback had helped them. So that's why I went into psychology.
Right. And so you felt you had a natural bent for talking to people, helping them, supporting them. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So that's why in 2005, I began my Bachelor of Science, excuse me, in psychology, applied psychology, at Heriot Watt in Edinburgh. And for 4 years I had aimed that I would go into, I wanted to amalgamate clinical and forensic, because I thought it was very important that if you're working with somebody who has a form of mental health, you know, who might themselves be taking lots of medication, or they might be suffering from some sort of ailment, however, there's a forensic side, because obviously, you know, they've done something to break the law, and therefore they're imprisoned, that was the area that I wanted to work in. I thought the two should go quite close together, because, you know, obvious reasons. And but there was no such course at the time.
Okay.
So I had decided that I would almost make my own.
Invent
in that
one.
Well, yeah, I thought, well, doing two masters in those areas and working in, because I worked voluntarily at Carstairs, which it's the state hospital in Scotland, where there were many patients there who were there, you know, sort of, and there was lots of forensic psychologists there, and I think there was only one clinical psychologist that would occasionally dot in and out. But I thought, if I worked in these fields, I could, if I did my master's in both of these, then I can sort of amalgamate them with my PhD, and I could come together and try to bring a holistic side into it. So this is taking bits of my past and what I had, you know, seen had helped a number of people, for various reasons, by the way, and sort of try to bring that into it as well. But Unfortunately, my own health took a bit of a back turn, and so I wasn't able to continue when I got to my PhD level. I had to, what I thought would take a little bit of time out, you know, so I was going to take a year or two out. And that was because over the years, again, my ailing health, which had been slowly getting worse, had got severely worse. So I was, some days I was unable to walk. I would have to be in a wheelchair because the inflammation was just too extreme. I had sort of terrible IBS. I had
irritable bowel
migraines.
Syndrome.
Yes, irritable bowel. It was just awful. You know, horrible migraines. I was having seizures. I was having, I would have a sudden blackout in my head. I heard an explosion in my head. So I'd hear this huge booming sound. My arms and legs would just flail in the air. Muscles would just spasm.
Like a spasm, yeah.
Yeah, and then if I had a tea or anything, it would just go flying. There was no control. There was no warning. So this would suddenly happen. And then immediately after that, I would have almost like a partial temporary paralysis. So I wasn't able to speak. I wasn't able to move. I would just have to steady myself. Everything would go black, and then quite quickly everything would come back. But it was the feeling of just not being able to speak. Have you ever had one of those dreams where you've woken up but you're not able to move? Your muscles are you can't lift your head.
Have you heard about this?
Yes, it was kind of like that. So I'm full aware of what's going on around me, but I cannot.
Not connected to your bodies.
I'm not connected. My muscles just weren't working. I couldn't voice what I was feeling. Fortunately, you know, Danny sort of learned to recognise when this would happen, and he would help me sit down and just give me, I would say a good sort of 10 minutes to be able to recover properly, and then before I could start speaking. And sometimes I would need a sleep for me to start feeling better. So, you know, it got to the stage where it was ridiculous. This wasn't getting any better.
So just out of interest, so what were you must have talked to some medics at this time. What were they saying to you about your condition?
My GP thought I had epilepsy, and so he had sent me to see a neurologist at the BGH, and which is the Borders General Hospital, the one near me. And when I had gone to see the neurologist, initially he didn't do any scans, he didn't do anything at all. He just sat and spoke to me for about 5 minutes and said, "Doesn't sound like epilepsy to me. I think it's a psychological condition."
That old chestnut.
Okay, yeah.
Anything you can't explain, it must be a psychological
condition. Under that umbrella, absolutely. So I was a bit sort of, I didn't really know what to say. I felt a bit embarrassed. I felt like a bit of a fraud being there.
Yeah,
because I thought, well, gosh, you know, this is really happening, but wow, what if it's just stress? Because, you know, it's quite hard to do degrees and be a parent. You know, I had two children at the time and driving quite a long way. Because I live in the border, so I was having to travel quite a long way into Edinburgh. And so I just left it, really. And then, but what had happened toward the end of my degree, these were continuing, but then it was becoming difficult to see clearly. So first of all, it was my peripheral vision that was always quite skewed. I couldn't quite work things out.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was a change in colour. And I only really noticed this when I was constantly saying, "This is such and such a colour," and you know, Danny or my daughter, who's very artistic, was saying, "That is not that colour that you're saying, right, Mum." You know, but then I shut one eye, and shut the other eye, and they were really different, hugely different. I couldn't believe it, and I had not noticed because I'd never done that, you know, patch over one eye test before. So, coupled with migraines and the loss of vision, the loss of eye colour, and just the fact that I was finding it quite difficult to see. I couldn't really get things into focus properly.
Mm.
And again, the two eyes were different. So I went to see my GP again, and he sent me then to see an ophthalmologist, again at the BGH, and he took some fantastic photos of the back of my eye, which I still have.
Yeah.
And he said, it's like the Thames in London, that, you know, because rather than it being sort of fairly smooth lines, it was just all over the place, up and down. And really contorted, really twisted, and he basically said, he pointed out what were called, I think he said they were like cotton wool spots, where there were blockages, and where the blood was trying to get through but couldn't get through, and it was causing these big, you know, sort of very angry looking veins in my eye. So this was where the blood would get to the retina, but it was struggling to get there, and therefore was, you know, the damage would have been, the retina would have eventually failed. And it was called a retinal vasculitis. And I asked him, okay, how has this happened? How has this come about? And he said that it could be a number of things, but I had had bloods taken. And with the bloods, he said that it didn't match any of these symptoms that I had. And he really wasn't quite sure at that time why I got it. However, having gone back a number of times, the severity of this, he was concerned that I was going to lose my eyesight completely. It was happening in one eye. I was terrified. And, you know, one eye it was happening in at the time, but the other one was starting. And he said within 10 years, it would be that you have no eyesight at all in either of your eyes. And because he couldn't work out what was causing it. However, what they could do was give me steroids. They immediately started me on these cortisone steroids.
Yeah.
And I was on a very high dose at the beginning, and it gradually tapered down. And however, the side effects to these steroids were horrific. My body, the inflammation in my body just went astronomical. I swelled up like a balloon. I'm relatively tall and slim. I always have been, as you can see. However, at the time, I think I was just, you know, I went up about 4 dress sizes very, very quickly. Wow. But majority of that was because I was getting awful edema. And and he said that
edema is fluid retention.
Fluid retention, yes. That's right. So my GP had said, but the pain as well, the pain in my joints were burning, absolutely burning. My guts were absolutely just in turmoil. The whole thing, the migraines, it was just awful. And my GP had said, I react really quite strong to medication. You know, he said, I do have a tendency to almost repel medication. And again, I just sort of felt like it's some a problem with me. It was my fault,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And so that was the initial sort of diagnosis that I had, retinal vasculitis of an unknown origin. And however, this is how they're going to treat it. I'd gone back to the GP several times, and then he had sent me to the neurologist again, because of my seizures and everything was getting a lot worse. And my GP had specifically requested for CT and MRI scans. So I'd gone for CT and MRI scans. And that is when they had found that I had, on my pituitary gland, I had a very small tumour, a very small growth, really. So it was it measured 9 mil, and it was what's called a pituitary microadenoma. And I was told that the likelihood that it was more than likely non-cancerous, because the majority of them are. I hadn't had a biopsy, but they said that they just very quickly said, okay, well, this explains why you're getting all the pressure on your optic nerve. This explains why you were having visual disturbances, why you were having the blood supply cut off. And also why, when they tested my blood, that it showed that I had hyperthyroidism, or it was, you know, the hormones in my blood were indicative of that anyway.
So this is the first real sort of bit of light thrown on your whole circumstance, actually.
Yes.
They found something wrong and could tell you what it was.
Yes, absolutely. So that was something that was completely, it just threw me completely. It kind of explained why my hormones were all over the place and had been building gradually. It explained why my eyes obviously were not working too well. Just a lot of things, really. But what I was quite concerned about was that they very quickly said, okay, well, what we do under these circumstances is that we offer transsphenoidal surgery, so where they go in through the nose and they basically just take it out, and, you know, quite a lot, depending on whereabouts it is, whether it's at the front or at the back of the pituitary gland, which is only the size of a bean, it's only very, very small anyway. They take the tumour away, they take the growth away. However, then you you have to go through a course of radiotherapy afterwards. Now, and this is something that obviously people with cancer have to go through, and it's something that I was just, you know, I was so worried about this and what it would mean, and, you know, having the rest of my life have to take medications. I wanted to do my own research.
Right.
Excuse me. I wanted to research this thoroughly first and find out, okay, what are the implications of having the surgery? What are the implications of having this radiotherapy treatment? What are the implications of not having it? And, you know, where are the studies of the people who have not chosen to go ahead, and what happens with them? And I looked at everything I could, and I had discussed it initially with my own GP when I had a routine appointment to go and see him to see how I was getting on. And I had said to him, I don't think I want to go ahead. And he said, well, okay, I understand why you're afraid. You've always been afraid of taking meds. You've never really liked that too much, Nanette. And, you know, this has been a family GP. He knew me quite well, and he knew I was always one for the natural approach wherever possible. And so he sent me back to the hospital to have a chat with, an endocrinologist that I had seen, and the endocrinologist had a nurse with him, and she was a Macmillan nurse, and she was there just to give me some advice and, you know, sort of what happens and so on and so forth. But I was, you know, pretty determined that I didn't want to go through this at this stage. If this was something that was not cancerous, I felt that if my body had created this, I wanted to see if there was a way that my body could undo this as well. So whatever it was that had built this up, could it be deconstructed, right, so to speak? I didn't really know. I just knew that I had never really worked out too well for me whenever I'd taken medication, whenever I'd gone down that route. So I wanted to try. I wanted to try, if nothing else. And the thought of having to be on HRT for the rest of my life, you know, I was sort of, I was, I think, 25 years old at the time.
Wow.
So, you know, it's still fairly young. I just,
prospect.
Yeah, absolutely. So I thought, well, okay, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to give it a try myself. Carried on, graduated at university, went on to do my first planned master's.
Amazing how you're getting through all this stuff and being a parent at the same time.
Yeah. I'm not sure how much of it is madness or dogged determination, but it was my goal. It was, you know, I think...
It sort of kept you going psychologically to have that.
Yeah, it definitely does.
Focus,
I think if you've got a focus, if you've got something you're working toward, it helps you get through each of the steps.
It does.
And it was a sort of huge saving grace to me, I suppose, at the time. But then I had further to travel to, because my master's and my start of my PhD was actually in Glasgow, which was a 3-hour drive there and a 3-hour drive back. Fortunately, I only had to go 2 days a week with it being master's. But I had started to do this. But unfortunately, during the time that I was on various medications to help deal with the inflammation problems and with the steroids that I was taking and everything else, my hormones were all over the place. And I had known this for a while, because I was struggling whenever I was struggling to balance out my hormones, and because of that my GP had recommended that I don't take any hormone-based contraceptives, because he said it would have quite a negative effect on me. So I had followed this, and what happened was, toward the end of my degree, I'd actually found out that I was expecting, and I had no idea. This was something that we didn't think would be possible at the time, because we had been sort of, you know, I hadn't had an ordinary amount of monthlies or anything like that, so we thought that perhaps that was changing. Anyway, long story short, when I found out I was expecting, I was already past the initial 3-month stage, and we had to go for a scan. I think it was about 15 weeks, I think it worked out on the scan, 16 weeks, and unfortunately they found that the baby had anencephaly. So that is where, it's a neural tube defect, so part of the brain hadn't developed properly, and that the baby would not survive more than a couple of hours if it was, you know, alive at all at birth. So the very difficult decision was made to induce the birth. It took a while for me to think about this, I must admit. By the time this actually happened and I'd gone into the hospital and I was in, you know, they took very good care of me, I have to say. They did at the hospital. I had my own room, and it was not an easy situation to go through. I think initially taking the initial tablet, which you know would sort of bring it all about, that in itself I think was harder than the actual process, because it's that mental decision.
It's the volitional part of it, isn't actually choosing to do this.
Yes, and that was so hard, and that because I just felt this tremendous guilt that this was all my fault, because I'd been taking all these medications and, you know, really not paying much attention to the areas that I should have paid attention to, such as making sure that, you know, I didn't conceive, for example. But I just didn't, you know, Danny and I had always been, you know, we had planned children, we'd always been very careful, so we just didn't think about it at the time, so it was a bit of a shock to the system. However, this event came about, and I don't think I ever allowed myself time to grieve, because I felt such guilt that this was my fault, that I almost
put it away.
Yeah, I think I just, I did, I packed it in a box, but I carried it with me constantly, and it was, you know, I just couldn't talk about it, it was terrible, you know, I was very, very low because of it, and then the doctor starts talking about, well, I think you should take a course of antidepressants, because, you know, you're struggling with, obviously you've got your degree, you're very busy, you've had this, you know, traumatic situation that you've had to go through. And I just sort of, you get to a point where you start thinking, I don't even know what is good for me anymore. You know, I'm just going to do what the GP recommends. And especially as this was the field that I was working towards, you kind of don't want to turn around and say, oh, well, that's a load of rubbish and that doesn't work, because, you know, I didn't see it as being the answer, but I was hoping it might help. I was hoping it might help me gain some clarity, so that I could then find a way of dealing with this, find a way of getting through, sort of putting together what had just happened. But it didn't, you know. So I started on yet another batch of meds, and again, eating the foods that the GP would recommend that I would eat, and which consisted of a lot of meat. You know, he recommended a lot of sort of iron and heavy meat things, and fish as well, lots of fish, he said. And so I just carried on with this and did my drive into Glasgow for my master's, and then within the year, it was Danny and I had spoke about this quite a lot, and we had decided that what we would do was I was going to have nothing to do with medication at all, because it wasn't helping me, you know, right at the initial stage when we were at the hospital, that had happened with the baby, and with my body feeling the way it was, and, you know, my mind not being able to gain clarity. I just didn't think anything was helping at all. So we decided that we would say, okay, enough, let's just do a big clear out, let's just get rid of all of this. And
it was a big decision.
It was a big decision, but I kind of felt at the time that I wasn't getting anywhere. I felt really stagnant, mentally stagnant, as though I'd been nailed into the ground, and I just couldn't move forward at all. And I just thought, you know, all of these, you know, they're having such a huge effect in my brain that I'm not aware of, that I'm not really fully understanding, because I'm not able to that time, you know. So I thought, and also the other reason was, we decided that we would take some time, and we would focus on having another child, but when it was right for us. So that's why when I got to the stage where Danny and I had decided that we would have another child, because I was, you know, it was something that I think I had thought so much about this since having having to go through that experience. I wanted to have another child so much, and I think this probably happens to a lot of people, where you sort of, you know, people perhaps have a natural miscarriage and then decide to have a child. It is a natural process. It is something. It can never replace the child that you no longer have. No, but it is
sort of healing.
Healing, and also it felt as though that was the way life was meant to go. So we decided that we would do this, but we made sure that I had no medicines at all. You know, I wanted my body to be as healthy as possible.
So this is the point at which you actually stopped all the anti-inflammatories, or everything.
Absolutely everything. So we got rid of all of that, and then and
just to, before you go on, just describe. You must have gone through a lot to. You were what? Just tell me all the things you were taking at that time and what it was like to stop them.
Okay, so I was taking anti-inflammatories. I was taking anti-anxiety medication as well, anti-anxiety, because my doctor had set me up with some tablets that would help me to sleep as well. Melatonin, is it? Melatonin, one that he was giving me. And and the steroids as well, the cortisone steroids. And anyway, so when I had decided that I didn't want to be taking anything else, I wanted to come off everything, and it was painful. It was very painful. So I was suffering headaches. I was having cold sweats. I was, you know, my joints were, a lot of the time my body just did feel like it was burning. It was really quite unpleasant. I wasn't really sure whether I was there or not for a while. So it made you feel a bit, I would say a bit like jet lag. So, you know, you're not quite sure what time of day it is. You're not quite sure of anything, and you can't, you know, when you're looking at things, it doesn't quite look real. It looks slightly surreal. So there was a lot of this going on, and but then whilst I was pregnant with my third child, Cassius, I actually felt okay. The pregnancy went remarkably well, and I wasn't really suffering too much, and I had quite an active pregnancy, so you know, did lots of walks and things. I hadn't changed my diet hugely at that point. I would say I was still eating, you know, ordinary meats and vegetables and everything else, but I hadn't done anything really with my diet at this stage. So when I went into labour, because I'm quite used to a lot of pain in my back, I hadn't realised that I was already in labour for quite a while, and then suddenly. My mother had travelled up from North Wales so she could be there during that week when I was due to go into labour, and she had come through the front door, and I was just about to put the kettle on and make her a cup of tea when she just looked at me. She said, "You are in labour." She just knew. Yes. Five children later, yes, she definitely knew. And I just said, no, it's fine, it's fine. And she says, "Nope, you're in labour, you need to go to hospital." Well, it was a good thing I did, because within minutes of her saying that, it was just completely different. And I could barely walk. Yeah, you know, I was contractions every 2 minutes and things. So she never did get that tea, not from me. But so we travelled to the hospital, and it was all fine, absolutely fine, from what I can remember. However, I think I was discharged about 12 hours later. It was very quick, because obviously third child, and I only lived a mile from the hospital, so you know, they were quite happy to let me go home, from what I can remember. But all I can actually myself remember is that I remember feeling very, very cold. I could not get warm. I had layer upon layer on dressing gown. I had the baby Cassius wrapped in my arms, duvet over me and over him, and I was just freezing, absolutely freezing. I had this blinding headache, and I just couldn't open my eyes. It just hurt too much to open my eyes. So this was into the next day, and I just couldn't speak. I couldn't drink. I couldn't eat. I couldn't really do much at all. And the midwife came round just to see me, and my mother had answered the door, and she said, "Oh, she's upstairs, she's sleeping, you know," and she was about to go, and then my mum just happened to mention, "She's not feeling too well," and immediately the midwife said, "I have to see her now." So she came in, and came upstairs, and this is all me telling you from what I've been told, because I actually have no memory of this myself now. But she came up the stairs and apparently took my temperature and immediately phoned for an ambulance, and I was sort of blue lighted away to the hospital. And strangely, I was taken back to the labour ward and hooked up to a lot of machines, and they found that I had actually contracted bacterial meningitis and septicemia at the birth.
Mm.
Where this came from, I really don't know. Nobody's ever really been able to put a finger on. I do remember, because I'd sort of slipped out of consciousness at that point. I was just, you know, I was pyrexial. It was a couple of days, I think, until I was able to sort of realise what was going on. And I'd had a spinal tap and various other things, and immediately hooked up to a whole host of antibiotic drugs, IV. And it was a few days later when Danny had said, there have been a stream of people coming in to see you, a stream of very, very concerned consultants all coming to see you. And it continued throughout that week, and, you know, all asking me all sorts of questions, absolutely everything you can imagine. And I couldn't understand why. I mean, I wasn't really able to, I wasn't able to communicate. My memory had gone completely. I wasn't able to remember much of anything. I couldn't process much of anything at that time. And looking back at it now, I really can't remember much before the labour, but certainly for 3 months afterwards, you know, there's just almost nothing. I mean, the next 3 months was only sort of fragmented. But and this is what I had, you know, I had to go through. I had to go through this complete body repair of what to me felt like just my memory that needed to repair, but it was actually a whole host of things. So I had to relearn how to speak clearly. You know, word recalling is something that I do struggle with still to this day, but it's most other things, you know, simple balance, all these sort of, I couldn't remember which way round I ate my cutlery, which was a very bizarre thing. There was all of these things that I had to go through. So, and at the same time as this, I found out that my son was actually born with a hypospadia, so he needed to go and have that repaired. This is when the genitals don't form properly. So basically, his penis was splayed open, and it hadn't formed a tube down the middle. And also, there's, you know, potential risks for him in later life. But what they do is they then, you know, they would sort of fold it back together, create a penis shape. But we chose for him not to have a foreskin put on there because the complications with that later on. So there's all these decisions that I had to make, which was about my son and his future, which was really quite hard for you to do when you're still struggling to remember, you know, your name. And
which way lunch.
Yeah, precisely. So it was just really quite, you know. But he was, for the most part, he was fine. You know, he didn't really seem to notice any, you know, he was okay. He didn't have any issues. Obviously, there was this surgery that was imminent. We decided that we wouldn't take him for surgery until he turned one, because the risks of surgery on a child before and after one, you know, sort of didn't warrant it being done before the age of one. So that gave me this time to try to recover from the meningitis and really try to get my head around just where it came from. And I don't think I really thought about that till about a year later. You know, how did I get this? How did I contract this at the birth? And it wasn't until I had decided at this point to take time out from my PhD. Because I just wasn't able to give
not
it anything. I mean, it was just, you know, everything was a bit too much for me. So I knew I had this time at home by myself with my children, and I just wanted to get things back on track. I just wanted, you know, to focus on, okay, Cassius needs to have this surgery. I need to recover from this properly. We have a son who has Asperger's, and we have to, you know, sort of accommodate his needs. And also I have this older daughter who's incredibly patient and incredibly loving. And, you know, she's sort of gone through all of this and she's just been...
It's tough.
Oh, yeah, tough, but children. Fantastic. I mean, I couldn't have done so much of it without her. Mm. Jessica has been a saving grace to me. But then, unfortunately for us, things changed again when Cassius went for his vaccines. Now, what had happened is, I think there'd been a delayed start to his vaccines because of me having meningitis. I wasn't too well. I wasn't really quite with it, if you like. So what we had done is we'd gone along and his health visitor had said, okay, he needs to have his vaccines. He's going to have a batch of them all done at once. And to bring him up to speed. I thought nothing of it because you think absolutely this is what needs to be done. And go for your life and let's just get him sorted. And it was, looking back now, the worst decision I could have ever made because unfortunately Cassius had quite severe adverse reactions to this. So what we didn't realise is that with the hyperspadias that he had, he also had certain difficulties with his bowels and with his, you know, digestive tract. So there was issues there anyway, I think, with the size and how much they were, you know, the muscles were contracting and how it was all working properly. And but when he had these vaccines, he slept almost solidly for about 48 hours. He would wake screaming, and these are screams I've never heard a child scream. I mean, it was just so shrill and so loud and so cutting. I was terrified. I was really scared. So I contacted the GP and I said, this is not normal. This is not right. What is happening? He's not eating. He's not taking any cues to eat. But he's screaming and screaming. And he said, oh no, it can be normal, you know, it can be quite sore or, you know, it can feel a bit lethargic for a while. But something just didn't sit right with me. It wasn't right, you know. And then a couple of days after that, I just noticed that there was no focus in his eyes. So you would look at him and he just didn't focus on you. He didn't look at you. Mm. He would look in your direction, but he didn't look at you. He didn't look into your eyes. Whereas he would always meet my gaze before. He would always have smiles. He would always be cuddly and quite active as well. Very, you know, and then he just changed completely. He, he didn't like to be held. He was, you know, there was all these funny things going on. He didn't like different sounds. So whenever, you know, we couldn't put the TV on because he didn't like the sounds, and he would just cry whenever the telly was put on, and then he'd be happier when the TV was off. And as he grew, as he got older, Danny and I said, bearing in mind obviously I'd trained in psychology and I'd covered sort of a lot of mental health and specifically autism, and I said, is this just me imagining this, because this is what I'm afraid of, because Sonny had much milder, but Sonny had gone through this as well. I just kept saying to Danny, I don't think I can be impartial enough to make this judgment, because I feel as though I'm putting all the information that I know in my mind and placing it into, you know, sort of like a jigsaw, and I'm creating this possibility. But then Danny would say, but it's the same for me, I'm thinking the same, and I never had your training, you know. So I said, okay, well, what do we do? And we discussed it with the health visitor and the GP, and they said, well, he's too young. So he was two by that time, and they said that, you know, they hadn't seen the change that I had seen. They hadn't been there during that week and witnessed that. And they didn't really know.
So when you say too young to give a diagnosis.
Too young to be diagnosed,
yeah.
For autism, to be checked, yeah, if you're on the spectrum or not. And I mean, they don't generally do it. I don't believe until they reach sort of school age, around about four. Oh, right. And I think it can be done early, but generally it's around about four. However, I just knew, and Danny just knew that, you know, here was a child that was most definitely was on the spectrum one way or another. Whatever had caused that and whatever it came about, I knew myself that this happened during that week, and it got predominantly worse. And actually, as Cassius got older, he was becoming much more, just living in his own little bubble, his own little world. So he would have his toys, he would have his routine. You know, you couldn't touch him, you couldn't cuddle him, you couldn't... He was very funny about clothes. If there was anything, anything appliqued onto a T-shirt, for example, as children often have these lovely patterns on their T-shirts, the stitching on the underside would scratch him and he would just scream and he'd have to take it off. And so there's all these things. I thought, you know, this is very... To me, it's very clear, it's very evident that he definitely is on the spectrum somewhere, you know. But I wasn't quite sure that I wanted to him to go through that whole process just yet. You know, I myself was still trying to recover, and I thought, right, let's just leave it a while and we'll see what we do. However, going through the stress of having two children, one definitely diagnosed, one more than likely, and then, you know, and one that was older, that to me felt as though she was being sort of neglected, so I would have to then do lots of things with her and try to take her places. We went travelling all around Scandinavia and did lots of things, just the two of us, just to try to make up for the time that, you know, that she was putting up with me and everything else. I think I just got overwhelmed, and I was becoming increasingly just quite low. I think I was so tired all of the time. I was, you know, there was...
So that had been consistent all the way through?
This had been consistent all the way through. So this had started when Jessica was born, but this had not gone away. And the inflammatory problems, they got better during the time of when I was pregnant with Cassius, but they were still there. So, you know, bearing in mind, I hadn't changed my food at this point. So, and I had sort of, I'd had a couple of years of taking medications, stopped completely. And then I was at this stage where I just felt I was exhausted, really. My plans for my career were just put on hold. I never knew if I was ever going to be able to pick them up again, especially as I had put so much effort into sitting my GAMSAT, which is my graduate entry into medicine, because I'd planned on taking my career further again and going into psychiatry so that I could work, you know, have a bit more control over my field and the area I wanted to go into. So, you know, and it was just a huge change in my life. And the fact that I didn't have any family or friends nearby, and so I was very isolated. It was just myself, and, you know, Danny was self-employed, so he worked every day. He wasn't able to sort of stay home. And it just became difficult, to say the least. So I decided that I would move. Danny would stay at the house in Scotland, but I would move down to North Wales and live near my mother, because I thought that having that family support there would help me to get through this. Now, during this move, during this whole year of planning this move, I had actually found out that I was expecting again, which is where the Saatchi, our fourth child, comes in. And it was another good reason why to move, because, you know, you're going to have four children. Mm-hmm. And it was good that you know, Cassius would have a friend that was quite close in age, because there was quite an age gap. There was almost 10 years between Cassius and Sunny, and obviously more with Jessica. So, you know, this was something that we thought, OK, well, this is what's happening. This is the direction our life's going in. That's fine. Danny stayed in Edinburgh, carried on doing work to the house, and I moved down there. Unfortunately, though... it didn't quite work out like that, and you know, things just continued to get worse. Now, one thing that I hadn't taken into consideration was just simple differences, such as like what was in the water. And, you know, I drink water all the time, and I was starting to get quite unwell again, and I just found that I just could not stop feeling anxious. I couldn't sleep properly. You know, I was very irritable. My hormones were all over the place still. And nothing was getting better despite me making attempts to make things better. Mm. So I ended up going through quite a dark patch. And in this dark patch, I had somehow, because I was on my own now, and, you know, not living with Danny, we were still together, but he was, you know, living, he would come down on the weekends to see the children, but he had to stay up in Edinburgh for work. So I decided that somehow it was all my fault, and that my children would be much better off without me. Now, this is a decision that I had come to when I wasn't really thinking all that clearly, I have to say.
Sure.
But I was convinced. I mean, I was utterly convinced this was the right thing to do. It was not a selfish thing. This is what I had to do because I was a burden to my children. And for every effort that I made to make things better, things seemed to get, you know, inextricably worse. So I just thought, I can't do this anymore. I'm exhausted. I can't go on anymore. And I made, over the course of, I would say about 6 months, I made a couple of attempts to go for the big sleep, really, if you like. And that's when Danny had decided to call in outside help. And he got a team called the Crisis Team, who would then they would come along when you're at, you know, your
NHS,
worst.
Crisis.
They're NHS, but yeah. The Crisis Team would come out to you immediately, you know, within 12 hours if they can of being phoned, and the ball would start rolling for you to then go and see. You'd have to go and see. It was a consultant psychiatrist, I think it was, that I saw. And he immediately, within the space of 1 hour of chatting with him in this room, I mean, I was struggling to speak. I was struggling to hold in the tears. I had so much that had gone on, and you know, this is not even including, you know, sort of my childhood. I had just so much that had burst to the surface, and I just thought, you know, still then, I just felt, I want him to understand why I felt this way,
right.
why this was my decision. And he decided that he thought very, very clearly at that time, just this doctor, he decided that he thought I had borderline personality disorder, BPD, which was something that I took this information. Danny had decided that he was going to ship his family back up to Scotland at that time. And I took this information from him and gave it to my GP, and my GP said, rubbish. He doesn't know you. No, he doesn't know your past. He doesn't know what you've been through. He's made this diagnosis very, very quickly. He didn't actually diagnose. He suspected. He said that this is what I think that it is. And he said, look, right, we're going to do this again, but we're going to go through somebody else. So I did actually come back to Scotland and decide.
You're lucky you had that GP who actually knew you.
Our
you?
Family GP,
when
yeah.
The superficial diagnosis you can make of somebody with having no knowledge of what's happened to them, and actually that their reaction to their circumstances might be completely understandable,
yeah.
Is just missing completely,
yeah.
You know.
And that's exactly what happened. He just made you should never diagnose somebody who's going through a crisis point. It speaks for itself, really. It's just because it is a crisis point. It's not, you know. So anyway, my GP, fortunately, who had been, he was a very good, very, what I would say, He would have a good bedside manner, so he would be the one who would take his time out. He'd come and see you. You know, they're few and far between now, unfortunately, because of money and everything else. But he knew this much about me, at least, that that wasn't the case.
Mm.
Nothing else. He said, I have patients with BPD. He says, you're nothing like them at all. So it was slightly relieving, I think, for both myself and Danny to hear that. I, you know, just wasn't sure which way was up or down by this point. But I was still, unfortunately, feeling that I was right. I was still feeling as though this was what I should really do. I should definitely consider this, because I just couldn't, I could only see things getting worse. But again, it was the state of mind that I was in. Anyway, unfortunately, my GP decided to prescribe a whole host of medication for me again, and he kept me in that room with Danny and said, I'm not happy for you to leave here without you taking these prescriptions with you. And they were a whole heap of, again, anti-anxiety ones, anti-epileptics, antidepressants, all of these things. He said that we need to get your seizures under control, we need to get your, you know, mental health back on track, we need to sort out your inflammatory problems, we need to do the blah, 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 blah. So I was then just given a whole host of tablets, and I was just thrown right back into the pit of things again. And within a couple of months of having taken these, possibly 1 to 2 months anyway, I was rock bottom. I mean, I was as rock bottom as I had ever been. I couldn't get out of bed. I couldn't dress myself. I couldn't stand up and go to the bathroom without feeling I was going to pass out. I couldn't speak to my children. Constant headaches, not being able to sleep, but not being able to, you know, being exhausted. There's all of these horrible things going on. And I just had enough. And I'd said to myself, you know, I have enough medication next to me in my bedside drawer for this all to be over very quickly and nobody needs to know.
Harrowing listening, I think you'll agree. I do hope you'll want to hear next week's conclusion to the story and the discussion that it promotes. Meanwhile, please do follow Yes to Life and me, Robin Daly, on Facebook and on Twitter. And if you haven't already seen our new book, The Cancer Revolution, do take a look at thecancerrevolution.co.uk. Goodbye.